Welcome to Create Your Bliss with Nika Annan. Today we have the great opportunity of talking to Katie Walker. Katie Walker is a multi-skilled creative with wide-ranging credits, including writer, editor, producer, designer, composer, music supervisor, cinematographer, and photographer. She also does jewelry. Her work spans fiction and documentary work, and her interests lie in conscious music, metaphysics, new science, nature, and transmedia storytelling. And I'm talking to Katie today about this fascinating movie that she is working on called Time is Art. So I will let her tell you about this. Welcome, Katie. So glad you're here with us today.
Thank you for having me, Nika. It's great. Thank you so much. So the film is pretty much more or less a creative and spiritual awakening story. A person that didn't believe anything. Her name's Jennifer Palmer. So it's a documentary film. Mm-hmm. Her story is really spectacular in the sense that it is a unique story, because a lot of people that go through the process of like the creative awakening or awakening to their life's purpose, you know, it either is something that happens over time or something that's like really quick, like a jolt. I mean, some people have like near-death experiences or they get in car accidents or whatever. So her story was really cool because she didn't believe in anything, and then she decided, to kind of do some research, because what ended up happening to her was more or less a supernatural experience. Her aunt had died, and she had this moment where she felt that she knew that she was leaving, and they were really close, and she had left, and this is all in the film, mm-hmm. and she left it was in Barcelona in the hospital. She left the hospital, and then she got this call, like, you know, this like inner telepathic sort of call, like, you need to go back, because she's about to leave, so pass on. And so she went back to the hospital, and turns out, like, literally within, you know, a very short period of time, and so her spirit had moved on and she passed on. And so she actually felt the experience, like she felt the energy, she knew that something had happened, and it was outside of her normal reality, which is this material realm where mm-hmm. everything is just, you know, money and work, and, you know, matter is just things and clothes, and it's just, there isn't anything sort of beyond that world. So it opened her up, and we call it the breaking open of the heart. It's kind of one of the terms that we use in the film. So then after she kind of realized that there's more to this, you know, the material realm, it sort of turned into a situation where she was able to write about it, and she was inspired to write, and then she realized that that was her true calling, that she was an artist and she was a writer, and that she needed to sort of quit her mindless day job that was not, that was keeping her from being her truest self. She was depressed and she had alcohol problems, and, you know, a lot of people have these experiences, so I think the story is kind of universal in that sense. Mm-hmm. So then through that process, she discovers synchronicity, and she starts to research and study and write about it, and it's a term that was coined by Carl Jung, and then people kind of picked up on it, and people have had this like fascination with it. The Police like named one of their most famous albums Synchronicity, and they had like two songs on there that sort of totally talked about how everything is connected. There really is, I mean, there are coincidences. I think there are meaningless coincidences to some degree, but I think there's a whole lot of meaningful coincidences that happen in our lives. And if we choose to really hone in on the more meaningful ones, the ones that really kind of lead you somewhere or connect you to a person or connect you to a creative opportunity or a professional opportunity, you know, it's kind of like this little signpost. And so that kind of also happens in the film. You have her sort of going through, and she discovers a lot of her synchronicities in like art, visual art, street art. And, as a person who lives in a big urban city, you know, she travels mm-hmm. to San Francisco a lot, and in Brooklyn and New York, oftentimes, you know, you get a lot of art around you because it's part of the beautification process of living in like a very, you know, urban environment. And it helps to inspire you too, because if you're somebody like me who really needs nature and really needs that connection, the art sometimes, which oftentimes has, you know, very deep messages, spiritual messages, and even just references to nature and all that, it kind of helps you sort of, you know, along your way. One day you might see a gigantic art piece and be really inspired. So I think that was part of her story too. And so we track that. And then we have these conversations that she has. We weave in conversations throughout the film, and the people that she speaks to, some of them are like, you know, extremely brilliant minds. This woman, Amy Lansky, she's a PhD. She's an ex-scientist from NASA that was working on artificial intelligence, and she kind of had her awakening and realized that she needed to go kind of a different route. And so she studies consciousness, but she uses all the things that she learned, you know, from a scientific standpoint. And then Rupert Sheldrake is a famous biologist. He's in the film. And so we were able to get a couple other folks that people know well, like Graham Hancock. He's also an established writer. He's been on a lot of documentary films, and he's really articulate. So she basically just goes through this process of meeting teachers, and she has a dream interpretation, and you know, she really experiences, like, it runs the gamut of like a really amazing journey. And so her idea is that time is, and this is an idea that came from Jose Arguelles, who's a visionary author and artist, and he passed in 2011, but he was one of the first like people that really pushed the Earth Day movement. And his whole idea was that we really got to come back in synchronicity with the planet, because we've just totally lost our understanding of where we fit into the planet. The planet has just become this like backdrop to us, and we're just, it's just extra. So instead of it being like it was, you know, during times of, you know, much earlier times, I mean, I guess we reached a sort of technological age, and then we just thought, oh, we don't really, it doesn't really matter anymore that we create all this trash, and it doesn't really matter anymore that we're not, you know, living in harmony with the planet. It seems extra, like it's not in the forefront. We're sort of distracted by all these material things and bad TV shows and all sorts of, it's kind of what I call just like silliness, because what's really important is living in harmony with the planet so that we can continue on, and obviously preserve the beautiful planet for our children. So in the film, that's a big piece, you know, we're tracking that, the idea that obviously we've reached a really pivotal point, and we need to, you know, check ourselves, and we need to start to really work together and figure out ways to build community around, you know, whether it be through your art, you know, activism through your art, where you're putting those messages out there, or your writing, your books. So I think it's just about, you know, putting conscious messages out there. And so that's what inspired Jennifer, the protagonist, and then throughout the film, she realizes that, you know, there, it's a really powerful idea that something goes from being psychologically embedded and kind of programmed into your brain, the idea that time is money, which is something you've heard since you were, you know, all over. You hear it from all these different sources growing up, especially in the United States, to time is art. So, and that's the Jose Arguelles kind of coined term that he sort of came up with, and his foundation talks about that in his work. He left that legacy. So time is art. It was inspired by him, and this idea truly that like we could potentially, if we really, you know, made the effort and became very conscious in what we did with our lives, we can live in a different world. We can live in a world that puts more importance on the artist and you know, being creative and enjoying life and being a part of the greater community of not only the planet but the universe. And that's really what time is art is all about.
That's really exciting and a lot of information. So let's go back into a little bit time as art as opposed to time is money, and really talk a little bit about that, because that's a pretty amazing idea that we have in this culture been taught to share the perception that money and the material world is the most important, and how many toys you have, you know, whoever has the most toys wins.
Right. I mean, I think it's really about the fact that we just become disconnected from these natural rhythms of the earth, you know, like all the sort of, you know, what people call paganism, but these indigenous cultures, you know, thousands of years ago, it was like they were tapping into it. They followed the equinoxes. There was just this understanding that we were part of this greater purpose, and that we had, living in a more spiritual, capacity. And it wasn't about this sort of like, this piece of paper, you know, money, because money is just, it's really just zeros and ones that they've created, you know, and the Federal Reserve System is a private company that just sets these interest rates and literally controls the value of this piece of paper. So the piece of paper could, you know, one day be worth nothing. And so what do we do then? What do we have then? So it's really about, I think, what most of us want deep down inside, whether or not, you know, we're totally aware of this. But I think subconsciously, without a doubt, people are ready to, you know, return to that foundation of culture, of community and creating. And you know, so that we have a beautiful planet and a beautiful world for our children. You know, the majority of people want to have children. They want to look to the future. They want to create a new and better world. You know, and if we could just sort of like get, it's like we're a deer caught in headlights. You know, if we can just kind of like sort of wake up to that greater understanding that, you know, if we just stopped for a second and stopped running around crazy, stopped running to work to get there on time to make a certain amount of money, that you know, so many people, especially people that work in technology, you know, my co-creator Maya, she also worked in commercial art realm, which is like working for kind of like MTV and some of these reality TV production companies. They're just like that. You work 12-hour days and you just, you're working. And yeah, you get paid a lot of money and it's great and all, you know, and you know, but then it's like, what do you do with that money? I mean, you've lost your ability to function in reality. You're stressed out. You're not happy. You're empty. And I feel like if we can just have come to a point where we're just having more of a balance between our work. I mean, I know people who love their work and they're obsessed with their work. They might be really successful artists or performers or musicians, and they're just overdoing it. They're overdoing it. And so they're just running and trying to utilize every little piece of time in the most, you know, productive way. And you're just like, they're just like killing themselves.
Right. And there's that whole place of burnout and that, I guess I don't know if this is a relevant perception, but for me, it sounds like there's a piece of that it's more about process than product. That
absolutely.
It's about how we do it and what is the quality with which we do it. Where's the connection to ourselves, to the planet, to all spheres of reality? Which I think is one of the things that we've been taught. And I find it very interesting that film is a very interesting medium that helps us, and we're not using it a lot in this way consciously as a culture, but helps us envision what could be.
Absolutely. I think the documentary film movement that's been so popular in the last 10 years or so, I mean, the documentary medium has exploded. When I was in school, I was working with a documentary filmmaker named Ellen Spiro, and she was literally one of the first women documentary filmmakers. And I remember one of the pieces she was working on was about Airstreams, how people would, you know, choose to retire, or even just, you know, kind of hippie folks. They would just like, I'm just going to go off the grid and live in this Airstream, you know. And that was really ahead of its time because, you know, that was a story that I really, really resonated with me, this idea that I don't feel a part of this greater sort of like, I guess, mainstream culture where it's like, you know, I need to work a 9-to-5 job. I need to work in an office with no windows. You know, I need to like be grinding away. Or even if you're, you know, an entrepreneur, you know, people now have their own businesses. You can still really burn yourself out. You can really lose track of what life is about, which is a balance. And it's very difficult because you're surrounded by those that are not in balance. So you have to take a step back from that and really try to see the bigger picture, because you're being influenced by our culture, the American culture, which is work, you know, and like you have no self-worth if you don't have some sort of job and you don't make, you know, a certain amount of money and you're not in some sort of powerful position and you're not, you know, telling people what to do or whatever. And so it's a very ego-driven, you know, materialistic culture. And so we all get sucked into that, you know. And so when the documentary film movement really took off, these films came out that were just like completely blowing my mind, blowing people's minds. And there's been more and more sort of conscious films, but a lot of them are like, you know, Gasland, which talks about the fracking. That just blew my mind, that story, that narrative of the guy in Pennsylvania and how he ultimately, you know, in Gasland 2 actually overcame the government, which was tremendous because most people's land just becomes worthless after it gets destroyed by these gas companies. So it was just really inspiring because I saw his story and I thought, oh my God, this guy actually was able to pull it off. And through the documentary film medium, he was just creating a whole movement. You know, it just gives me chills like that, you know, thinking about how this medium can really affect people's lives now. And it's because it's real and because you see a real person, I think it's more powerful. And not to, you know, downplay scripted films, because I think fiction and, you know, I think imagination is very important. We need to, you know, really sometimes step outside of this reality so we can imagine a better reality or a more beautiful, magical world. But the filmmaking process of making a documentary, especially with Time is Art, where we were like literally, you know, we weren't really tracking her in the typical follow doc style. It was very experimental. You know, we took the synchronicity as a theme and we just kind of weaved it in and out. And I can reference a film that is by Richard Linklater. And a lot of people have seen this film. It's kind of a cult classic. It was really under the radar when it came out. It's called Waking Life. And he became famous because he was doing this thing called rotoscoping where he would have painters actually paint on top of the film.
Oh, wow.
So it's really, he did Scanner Darkly, which is also a really beautiful film. So he really talks about a lot of existential, you know, ideas, metaphysical ideas, but he puts it into it such a way that people kind of don't even really know that that's what he's doing. So he's, I think by heart, Richard Linklater is definitely like a Buddhist, you know, but you wouldn't totally know that. He doesn't put that out there in that way. I think he uses the form to really try to get people to think about like reincarnation and think about dreams and what does it mean, you know, this alternative reality that we can enter when we go into a dream state. And so Waking Life is kind of about that. And it's just a person sort of wandering through Austin, Texas, where I went to school. And, you know, I got to know some of the people who worked on that film. So that was like a big inspiration for me, this idea that those were actually real people in the film. Yeah, one of the main guys was like an actor, but it was like he was going through the town and talking to real people. And so I thought it was just really interesting. And I think most of the time with, you know, the film making process, it is an experimental process because you don't want to push it. And I think with even art, visual art, anything, you kind of just see where it takes you. And that's what's cool about synchronicity as a theme, as a big weaving sort of theme that came through us and through the process of writing a lot about it and researching Carl Jung and like getting really into this like psychological aspect of it and what it means to go inward, you know, what it means to have these inner connections with the outer world. And so it was really great to be able to sort of just like let it flow and let things happen. And so one of the beautiful things that we were able to manifest through the process was to go to this symposium that we ended up doing our first crowdfunding campaign. We raised money to go to Joshua Tree. So it was just a super magical place if you ever get a chance to go.
I actually was there. Actually, I was at this conference.
You were at the Synchronicity Symposium?
I was at the Synchronicity Symposium.
Did you meet Maya there? That's probably how we connected, I think.
No, I don't know how.
She got your card, so
must have met her then.
That's how we follow up with her.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Maya is the co-creator, co-director. It's like me, my husband, Joel, Maya, and all of us are sort of like co-creators. We all sort of have done a bunch of different aspects of it. Joel and I are the main editors. Joel is like the primary editor. So it's like this really DIY small team of artists. And so I think that's where she probably ran into you. But that place, that was just amazing, wasn't it?
That was so extraordinary. It was really a beautiful, for people who have not been there, it was, I don't remember the name of the place, but it's out in the desert in Joshua Tree, California. And it's just stunning. It's full of Joshua trees and a beautiful spiritual place. There's a labyrinth. And then the people who came were amazing. Really
absolutely
amazing.
And so what happened is we ended up filming 12 kind of scenes there. Mm-hmm. So we got Joshua Tree is kind of a theme in the film, like the idea of plant intelligence and reconnecting to nature. Because I really felt almost like they were speaking to me in moments where I was like, these are really special plants and trees, and they're actually yucca plants. And so it was just a really magical experience to be able to film there. And so half of the film is actually part of the symposium. And so we track, Jennifer going through the process of being inspired by these different presentations. And then she got a dream interpretation from Tokopa Turner, which was she was a speaker. Mm-hmm. Her presentation was really powerful. So it was kind of like, you know, showing the process of someone who's doing research, who's really looking for the answers. And that symposium, you know, Gary Bobroff, who put it on, he's in the film too. That symposium was just incredible. It was like all these different people coming together to really do something that I think is extremely unique in the sense that you're bringing metaphysics, you're bringing psychology, you're bringing biology, ecology, like self-awareness, just therapy. There's a lot of like, I felt like energy workers and therapy folks. There was art, visual art. There was just sort of everything coming together under one roof. And so the chances for us to be able to get some of these folks like Rupert Sheldrake, he lives in England. Of course, we didn't have the budget to fly out there, nor would we have the chance to get Graham Hancock, who's also, lives in England. It's like we were able to get everyone sort of at one in one place. So it was just magical. It was truly magical. Yeah. And so I think that's a big part of the film. You'll see her walking through that labyrinth that you're talking about. She walks through the labyrinth, which is a big theme in the film too. You know, the labyrinth represents, there's a lot of symbology in the film. I'm pretty fascinated by symbology, which is also something Carl Jung really talked about in one of his famous books called Man and His Symbols. Mm-hmm. You know, how there's a symbolic language, you know, and even crop circles are symbolic language. There's just messages being transmitted in some of these symbols like the labyrinth. And it's a really deep, multi-layered meaning that maybe you don't get totally on the surface, but after a while it starts to sort of work into that subconscious mind, you know, which was what Carl Jung talked a lot about.
That's so exciting. That was a very amazing experience. I actually had a wonderful interaction with Tokopa there because the big Joshua tree out in the back, there's one that was by itself where they did the music. Mm-hmm. And I have a very strong connection to trees. And so I was out talking to it and it said, I want to meet her. So
I
walked up to her after she'd finished speaking and I said, excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I have a tree friend that would like very much to meet you.
That's awesome. I mean, I shot like the poster artwork you'll see mm-hmm. is a Joshua tree. And that shot was really cool because she was like, we had really limited time. And again, it was like, we were so excited and I had reached out to Tokopa like a week before. So luckily I'd kind of lined up her up, you know, but the rest of the folks weren't as lined up because they're so busy. And I don't even think, you know, Rupert Sheldrake like emails people. I mean, he's just like, you know, he's kind of this old school guy. So it was like to get a hold of these people was just like going to be synchronicity, whether it was going to work or not. But with her, we were able to really like set it up and we did a dream interpretation with her, which was cool because most of the other interactions are more just conversations, but hers was an actual kind of session. Nice. So she did, yeah, she's like a dream walker and she kind of knows how to like, you know, and so the reoccurring nightmare that the character Jennifer had, it was, you know, it was interpreted as something is, I love this part in the film. She says something is ready to come to consciousness, you know, and so when you have these reoccurring dreams, you know, it's like it's something's ready to come forward, that your dream world is your subconscious. And it's your subconscious makes the majority of your decisions you don't even know. That's what's crazy. So we have to figure out how to get what's in our subconscious to come to consciousness.
Mm-hmm. And how do we make friends with it?
Exactly. It's not easy.
Well, yeah. And learn to understand its symbology because it's very complex and very personal. And very often our subconscious does not present things, you know, in a linear, direct information. It's like, mm-hmm. well, here's this story. And you're like, okay, so what's this, you know, the dream, the nightmare? What is this story about? You know, what am I telling myself? What am I trying to figure out?
Yeah, I mean, time isn't linear. You know, time is cyclical. And mm-hmm. so if you study any of the indigenous culture, especially the Mayans, their calendar, the way they understood time, it just was a cycle and it never, you know, really, there was really no beginning and an end. You kind of repeat the same thing. And so I think that that's what we're really, it's really about for us as a society. Let's not make the same mistakes that we made before. Let's not build this high civilization and then just, you know, destroy it with greed and, you know, selfishness and exploitation of resources. Let's not do that again because, you know, according to a lot of the texts, if you follow, you know, any of the Atlantean studies mm-hmm. and the books that are out, you know, we were a part of it. Yeah, there might have been a deluge or some catastrophe, but it was like you can create an imbalance with the planet and the planet will fight back. You know, I think the Earth is a conscious being and the sun's a conscious being. All these planets are very conscious and they affect us and we just don't quite understand it. It's sort of beyond that, you know, sort of the average understanding, because it's, wow, like a planet is a consciousness. That must be a massive force to be reckoned with. You know, living in Brooklyn, that when the Hurricane Sandy hit, without a doubt felt that it was, that night I woke up, I stayed, and we're on the second floor, so we were okay, and our building is a newer building. And so all the brownstones in the area were completely destroyed, like the basements, because the way they didn't build them, you know, to spec or whatever. But like our building was a newer building, so we kind of knew we figured we'd lose electricity, which we did for like weeks, but we were fine. So I stayed just because I just felt like I needed to experience that, and that the energy of that storm, I felt it and I understood it, and I felt it was a communication. I felt there was a communication coming from the consciousness of the planet and saying that, you know, this is an imbalance. First of all, they polluted the Hudson River. I mean, it's just a massive, a dump of, you know, chemicals for centuries. GE like was dumping the PCBs and all this. So it's like when all that stuff was washed into our community, it was kind of like a wake up call. It was like, do you understand that this whole body of water used to be life? There used to be life in this body of water, and you've destroyed this life, and now it's time for you to, like, you know, bring it back. And so a lot of that toxic waste was actually washed into our neighborhood. And there was a farm in the neighborhood. It's an urban farm, and we go there and compost, and I volunteered there a couple of times, and they grow a lot of food, and they work with the local youth, you know, they do community service. And so that entire farm was destroyed because all the chemicals that were in from the Gowanus Canal, which is like one of the most polluted bodies of water in like the country or the world or something. I don't know. You know, it's definitely just pure like PCBs and oil and like sewage and all this stuff that just rushed into the neighborhood. And it was just such a wake up call. It was so obvious to me. And unfortunately, I don't think everyone got that message from the planet, you know. Just like you talk to trees, unfortunately, not everyone can have that communication with other beings. But it was a message. It was a message. It was like, wake up. And I love how, I mean, I'm not saying I love this, but the hurricane really wiped out parts of Wall Street. And I thought, well, that's kind of ironic, you know. And so I just feel like the planet has a consciousness. The planet is able to really fight back in its own way. And that the planet is going to exist, and, you know, we may not, you know, and so we just need to step it up. It's such a pivotal choice point right now. So that's why this film to me is really timely. We want it to come out on a specific day. In November, we were ready to release it. We need people to see this film. We need people to be inspired by, you know, the art and the science and the storytelling, and the idea that we're all connected is really powerful. And I think if this film does come out, and right now we're raising money to complete it, if we are able to raise the money, and you can go to Indiegogo and check out our campaign, just search for Time is Art, that is a beautiful way to, you know, build the community prior. You can pre-order the film prior to it coming out, so that'll help us finish it. So a lot of what we're doing is just post-production right now, and we're just doing this extra stuff that people don't realize how expensive it is. It's very time-consuming. The sound and the color correction, things that are just sort of seem extra but are really crucial to getting like a wide distribution. And we have the ability, you know, now to crowdfund theatrical releases too. So we wanted it to be in Austin, or we wanted it to be in Santa Fe. Of course, I would love for it to be in Santa Fe. What we do is you put it on one of these websites, these startup companies, and people can purchase the tickets. And if it makes, you know, if enough people are interested, then it'll be screened in a local theater, art theater there. So that's the beauty of, you know, the world that we live in. We now have all these ways for the average kind of DIY filmmaker to like get their film out, you know. And so that's what we want to do. We want to get it into places like Santa Fe, conscious places like obviously like Sedona and San Francisco. We filmed in San Francisco. We filmed in Joshua Tree. We made, you know, wanting to get these communities to get exposed to this. And then hopefully even the average person might be interested in it. You know, you never know. So it's a big project, but I think it's timely. You know, it's time for us to really put these conscious, you know, music. We make conscious music too. We're really driven to like put out these messages that are inspiring people to sort of step away from this like mainstream sort of, you know, if you watch the news, I mean, you're not going to get anything, but just sort of, honestly, I think it's just majority of it is garbage. Yeah. You're going to get distracted. you're gonna feel sort of overwhelmed. You don't feel empowered. It's definitely not inspiring, you know, unless it's something, you know, every once in a while, of course, they'll throw that in there, but there is a lot of people that are doing things for the planet. There are a lot of conservation groups. There are, you know, they're not highlighting those things. And so we need to highlight those things. We need to show that there is a movement, and we need, through film, you can do that. You can kind of gather folks together around an idea like synchronicity, or an idea like visionary art, which is a lot of what we have in the film, is art from Alex Gray, who's a person that sees how everything is connected. I mean, you can look into his paintings, and he has this like thing called the universal mind lattice he talks about in the film. And it's just showing how everything is connected. I mean, from the ant and the bee, which we all know are we wouldn't exist without the bee, which is under attack. And we're connected to every little thing. It's all connected. And we're connected to different, you know, power points on the planet, you know, where temples are built through the ley lines. I mean, this is all the stuff that's in his paintings. And what's really cool is we talk about that, and we can see it. You know, he actually is able to like manifest these incredibly intricate paintings where it's like you actually can see a way, or he at least is able to show through extreme detail how connected we really are. And it's really powerful.
That's really beautiful. And it's so nice to have it happening and to have the energy going between people, because I think so many of us have done it in isolation for a long time.
Absolutely.
You know, and
even Jennifer, she was in isolation. I've gone through a great deal of isolation. I mean, if you're a writer, if that's your medium, that can be really isolating. You know, and a lot of artists in general, they have to, you know, it's a solo thing if you're a painter, you know. And I think people are breaking out of the mold and they're doing more collaborative work. Like, we filmed like a really cool collaborative piece between a bunch of street artists, and they're in the you know, the guy offered his space and he said, okay, all you guys can come in here and make these gigantic pieces, but with one kind of guideline, is that two people have to work on one painting. So it was just cool. Mm. So they were able to merge their forms, you know, and they kind of had completely different styles, you know. This whole kind of street art mural movement, like, there's really not one particular style anymore. You see everyone kind of doing something different. And so it was cool to see that how they combined the styles. And I thought that was really enlightening. And I think people that were kind of maybe even stuck in their medium or had their style of painting or whatever they were doing, it helps you break free of that. And so I think with Jennifer Palmer, when she comes to the realization that like community and sort of building it through ayahuasca communities or communities that are, you know, spiritual. Like, I do a lot of ceremonial work, like sweat lodges. Mm-hmm. And the people that I've met, I'm sure you do that in Santa Fe as well. It's probably extremely popular. It's that whole community aspect of the tribe, of how we used to help each other. We used to be very, you know, engaged in each other's lives and on a spiritual level, as opposed to just like a material level, you know. Just, I'm not saying that collaboration isn't great too, and working together isn't really important, but you have to also, you know, because what part of what I would do a lot is I would collaborate with people. I was always collaborating, and I've never been a person that really likes to do anything solo, because I just, right, it's just not my style. So, but then, you know, throughout that experience, I've gotten to the point where I did overwork myself, and I wasn't really giving myself the time to build relationships just on a personal or spiritual or a, you know, on a different level. And I think when you get involved in the ceremonial world with doing sweat lodges and doing dances and just doing these things that just are really connecting you to the source through a community, that's when you really become enlightened. And I think if you do it by yourself, I'm not saying you shouldn't be, you definitely should meditate. And there's so many things you have to do by yourself. It's so important to go inside and just take a break and really balance out the outside world from your inner world. But it's a balance, and I think you've got to do the work to work alone and build your own self-worth and who you are and your original ideas. And then in the process of that, you really have to go outside of that and reach out to others and try to find that community, because sometimes it's really hard to find people that are like you.
Right.
I think that's what's really, that's difficult, and especially since some people are so unique, and, you know, we're really unique individuals. We're very special. And so sometimes it is very hard to find someone who thinks like you, who is interested in what you're into. And so you can feel really alone. And I know in New York, I definitely went through that phase, you know. You probably did too. You lived in New York for a couple of years, for 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very hard because trying to find, there's so many people to try and find the ways to connect with people.
It's almost too many. And then it sort of cancels it out almost.
Right. Right. That they're, and they may be next door, but you don't know because you don't know anybody.
That's an American cultural, I think, degeneration of our society happened when that started to happen. Because at one point, I don't think that really was the case. I mean, there was always like a lot of segregation and racism and stuff. And, you know, that, you know, has transformed itself to some degree. But I just feel like people still had a more of a neighborly attitude at one point. And then we just kind of got more and more separate. Separation happened through however you want to look at it. Maybe it was, you know, the iPhone and, you know, staring at your phone and staring at your computer, you know, and you get on Facebook and you are so connected at the same time as you're not connected.
Right. The people like, you never see and you have no, you don't know if what they're telling you is, I mean, if they're close friends, you do, but you don't really know if what they're telling you is real or not.
Yeah.
People can invent personalities and it's very interesting. Yeah, so, and I think that art is also a way of bringing the worlds together, all the different kinds of art, and that they're ways into ourselves and ways, creating art is a way into community, and that creating community is a form of art.
Indeed, I think there's a really big community built around visionary art, live art. I've noticed, like when you go to these sort of these conscious festivals that have kind of popped out. One of the most beautiful one I've seen recently is called Beloved. It's out in Oregon, and they're doing these incredible events that are, you know, they're pretty much sustainable festivals that aren't destroying the land like a lot of these big commercial, you know, music festivals with, you know, Kanye West or whoever's headlining. And that's a commercial endeavor and that's about making money. But if you look at some of these communities that have been built around the sacred art, sacred geometry, the visionary art, you know, obviously like the yoga, the conscious music, the the communities built around really deep-seated ideas of connection. That's kind of what it's all about, really. And I didn't know of this until I wish I would have known about this a little bit earlier. I don't know how I missed this, but I didn't realize. I mean, I knew about Burning Man, which to me is I felt like torn going there because I went there in 2011, and it was right before it really exploded. But they didn't have a lot of like sustainable practices happening at the time, and I was really upset, and it was really bothering me because I'm like big into, you know, just doing the basics, like, hey, you know, just put the glass bottles in a bag, it's not going to kill you, you know, just do some basic stuff. And so I was like upset because apparently they've implemented them more, but I was just upset with that. I thought it was a beautiful concept of not spending any money when you get there. There's no such thing as money. Mm-hmm. In fact, you completely remove the idea of commerce or anything. Everything is bartering and exchanging and trading. And that's a big part of, I think, this whole time is art mentality. This new reality is that we are learning to exchange our services, you know, and I think a lot of what we've done in this film is we exchange services. Even just to the making of it, but that's a message in the film that I think also resonates, is this idea that we don't have to exchange like the time for the dollar bill. Like the time can be used. My time can be used and your time can be used to actually create something. And then we exchange that or a service, or I get a reading from you or a therapy session and then I do your website, or, you know, it's just this sort of bartering system. And that's that's what these communities are doing now. You know, I went to a festival called Unifier, you know, and I write for a music magazine, you know, and so the idea of, okay, you get a media pass and you go and you document the whole festival and you do a bunch of social media and you share it and you do all these things to get people to know about it. And you didn't have to pay for a ticket. You know, it's like those kinds of things, I think, are sort of like the next phase of existence. And I think a lot of people that are creative are doing that now more than ever. They're realizing that that's also part of their creativity, not just making their art, but like, how can I do something that is equal to what you're providing so that we can just make it a bartering and exchange.
Yeah, and that whole flow, and how do we be more people to one another as opposed to abstract digits, which is a real reaction to how people are treated more and more in the cubicle workplace that you were talking about, where it's not about being people. Yeah,
and you can't remove the dollar bill, obviously, from society 100%. That's obviously not where we're at, but it doesn't mean that we can't have a part bartering system. Like, what if half of our system was bartering and the other half was dollar bills? You know, I think that that's very possible, and I think it's already happening on a much larger scale. And in fact, I was like, I've always been inspired by that. I was working on an idea for a documentary that talks about that. Like, what does it mean to barter, and what does it mean to be a part of a system that is off the grid, that isn't a part of the system? What does it mean to, you know, build or be a part of an eco village or have a house that's completely off the grid, that's self-sustaining? And how is it that you have one foot in, one foot out? How does that work, you know, on a psychological level? Because I think that can be really, it can be really difficult for me. I know I feel one day that I'm really in this new paradigm, and then the next day I'm kind of not, or one day I'm sort of half in it, and the next day, you know, one day I'm half in and I'm half out. And so it can be disjointed. It can be very kind of, it throws you off when you feel like you're ready to be done with this old thing. You're ready to move on. You're ready to just go, you know, full-fledged into this other world where we're actually, you know, there is free energy, or there's sustainable energy, or there's clean energy, and there is an exchange, and there isn't exploitation, and there isn't slave labor, and people, you know, care about each other. It doesn't matter the color of their skin or their sex or sexual preference. Like, I'm ready for that. You know, I think a lot of people are ready for that, but that's not what's happening, you know, on in this other reality. And so how do we do that? How do we deal with the time is money versus the time is art? You know, how do we jump back and forth between that? Because I have days where it's really difficult, and I kind of get into a darker place. But the challenge is the challenge is what makes us who we are. I mean, there wouldn't be a film if Jennifer Palmer didn't go through this, if she didn't start being a complete atheist and believe in nothing and think that, you know, she had no purpose to her life, and then become challenged to come to the realization that through synchronicity, there is a greater, you know, force at work that has connected us. And it may not be in a physical reality always. It might be in this other reality, this other dimension, but that it exists, and it may not be clear every day. You don't wake up and it's just, oh my God, everything's connected and da da da. No, that it's not every day that happens, unless you're like a Buddhist monk and living in a temple, you know.
I think even then, you know, the human life is a struggle. I think the thing is that, can we bring ourselves back to it? It's like meditation, you know. Mm-hmm. All that stuff comes up and it's like, yeah, but where are my values? What is my choice in this moment? How do I be in this moment? And then to keep moving forward and not to berate ourselves for what happened last moment, whatever that was, you know.
It's a difficult process because when someone really attacks you, or you're questioned, your ethics are questioned, or let's say you feel like you have outstanding ethics and that you really live in, you know, in a way that you feel is giving back. Maybe you work in, you know, work with kids, or, you know, you're, and then someone one day attacks you and says that you aren't what you say you are, or whatever. And so how do we respond to that when we're being attacked, our most inner core, who we are and who we stand for is being attacked? That's when it gets really difficult. How can I step back and not respond in anger and not become the lower, you know, the person that is sucked in by this energy vampire type of activity? It's like, how do I rise above that? It's extremely difficult to transmute that. When I am, you know, attacked, or I feel a sense of I'm really offended by maybe, like, you know, Donald Trump or something like that, and I block most of that stuff out as being just silly, but if I really feel attacked, or I've really see someone becoming attacked, especially with the police brutality stuff, it's like, that really bothers me. And like, how do I really figure out how to do something about that in a way that, is going to empower me? 'Cause that's really what it is. If you hold it in and you just dwell on it and you don't really make any action, and you kind of, even if it's a blog post or just a social media tweet, like something, like just
right.
let it out. Like do something that's going to sort of transmute that in the best way that you know how. And it might be a really small thing. You might sign a petition, you know, what do those things do half the time? But it's like, Just that little thing I think is really what it's about. Cause it's just a psychological battle that you're having with yourself. Like, you know, I might be this person who's really spiritual and who's really balanced and all this and that, but you know, I'm constantly am bombarded with people who aren't. And so how do I deal with that? Especially in New York, there's so many people. Like I was on the train yesterday and I just was like checking everyone out, and I'm not trying to judge or just assume. And again, I am judging and assuming because I'm sure there were people on that train that were, mm-hmm. you know, maybe not what it appeared to be. But I just feel like a lot of people are asleep. A lot of people are asleep to the reality of you know, what's happening, and they're running away from it. They don't want to face the dark night of the soul. People don't want to face the darkness. They don't want to face what happened on 9/11. They don't want to face the lies from the government. They don't really want to deal with that stuff. It's just too heavy. And I would rather go and, you know, watch my, you know, American Idol or whatever it is you're doing, or right. get on Facebook and just, you know, click. Cause it's so funny when I look at people on their phones, they're just like scanning. It's like, just going images, text, just like, just, you know, it's
right.
Like,
right.
It's just like, what are you doing? You know? But yeah, I get sucked into it too. You know, I get sucked into like looking at my phone and like staring at stuff like, what am I doing? So,
yeah. What happened to all my time? Whoops, I forgot that. Yeah. And yet at the same time, there's these beautiful gems in that as well, and ways to connect to people. And it's, again, it's so much about our focus and our, you know, there's this thing called the reticular activating system, which is what do we notice? And to try and consciously set it so that we're looking for at least part of the time what feeds us and what enables us to keep going.
Yeah, and that's what synchronicity is all about. I think you can notice the synchronicity and say, okay, I keep seeing, like, I'll tell you a synchronicity I had, and it might not seem, it seems more of like a meaningful coincidence, but I did this workshop a couple of days ago, and it's about trying to teach youth how to, about social justice issues, like how to work them into your curriculum without like offending people. You know, some of this stuff is really tricky. So it was kind of all about the police brutality, stuff that's happening in New York and how many people have died. And so we went through like six different people, and they were like, you read a Guardian article about the person. So we got this person named Sean Bell, who was like killed on his wedding day by these like crazy cops that thought it was like they got the, you know, completely wrong person. They shot up the car like 50 times. It was like super amateur hour. Like, you know, I don't even know. They just get these cops that don't even know what they're doing. So this poor 23-year-old person who had two children and was a, you know, just, it wasn't, it just, it was just such a tragedy, was shot. And then, you know, so ended up writing a poem about it. So I wrote a poem about the wedding, and it was from the perspective of his wife, you know? So I'm writing this poem, and it really was just so moving. And so a couple of, you know, like a day later on the table, the next day at the workshop, they had like all these poetry books, and they were books that were, that they'd worked with kids, you know, and the books were about everything. It wasn't just like the police brutality stuff. It was like all these different books. It was like poems that came from anything. And it was just working with youth to get them dealing with really important issues through poetry. And they were, you know, really cool little books through this organization called Community Word Project. So I'm sitting there and I'm going through all the books, and I pick up like the third or fourth book, and I literally flip to a page. Like I just literally the first page I open, I look at it, and it says The Wedding.
And
then I just start reading the whole poem, and I just get chills throughout my whole body. And it's the exact, it's very similar to the poem that I wrote too, in the way that they wrote it.
But
it was about Sean Bell, the wedding, you know, the massacre at the wedding. And it was just chills totally went through my body. And I was like, wow. So it's like we're tapping into something when we pay attention. And so I looked at that and I really thought, like you said, when you pay attention, what do we choose to focus on? I chose to focus on it and see the connection and see that was really powerful, you know, that I'm able to tap into that realm of when I choose to focus on things that are really important, what happens to me? I'm inspired. I'm motivated. I'm in tune with the source. I'm, you know, I'm at my highest purpose. I mean, I'm in my highest purpose. It's like in the days that I'm not choosing to focus on those things, I'm not.
Right.
So yeah, we just have to, like you said, it's about what you focus on and what you choose to put your energy into. But like you said, it's sometimes it's really hard to do that because we are so overwhelmed with information every day.
Yeah, and to go back to choice and to realize when we're overwhelmed, okay, let's pick the one thing. What feeds me? What keeps me going? How do I? What's the next step in my journey? It's an interesting place of bringing ourselves back. And
I think that's a big message in the film too. There's this guy, Richard Tarnas, and he talks a lot about Carl Jung, but he really is about like the going inward, the dark night. He calls it overcoming this sort of dark night of the soul. Mm-hmm. And what needs to happen when you go inward, what that process is. And, you know, the self-awareness issue and the self-reflection, like you are me and I am you idea. When I'm really able to really self-reflect and become a self-aware individual, like what happens right. then? It's a powerful thing, you know, it's right. truly the, it's like, it's incredible that, you know, if we can just tap into that, if we can just be self-aware at all times and be aware of our thoughts, because I think there is a lot of this weird programming going on and where these thoughts, like, why don't I 1 second I have a thought that says you can do this? And then the next second I have a thought that says you can't do this.
Right.
Like what's going on there? What is that?
Where does it come from? And what do you do with the negative voice? And how do you, yeah.
It's just a very strange thing for me. And I think a lot of people have those two opposing voices all right. the time in their head.
Right.
And, you know, where does that come from? I don't know. I don't know. Is it programming, subconscious programming from watching things when I was a child that was negative? I don't know. But it's there and I can't block it out. I mean, I can block it out in the sense that I hear it, but like, I just, you know, I can't make it go away. I can't make it go away. There's always that little weird voice that's like this, you know, it's just negative, a negative voice that just doesn't do anything for me. And I think that if I can figure out how to kind of quiet that voice and maybe in meditation, you know, and yoga and things like that, that's how we are riding your bike or walking in nature. I mean, when I'm walking in nature, I really don't have that voice. There isn't that voice that's like, you know, you can't do this, or this is you know, a disaster or whatever, right. you know, that just doesn't happen. And so I think it's like, maybe it's projections from other people too. When you live in really close quarters, especially in New York, a lot of people are projecting ideas and thoughts.
And you just pick up on the
energy. And you're almost like a radio transmission. And it's like, you can dial to that to that channel accidentally, because you don't really know what you're doing, because right. we don't really understand our minds and our consciousness. We don't get those tools in school. You know, Rupert Sheldrake is one person that's in the film, and he really has if you read his books, it just makes so much sense. And it's yes. like, that should be curriculum and that should be in schools, you know? But so we're getting those projections, I think, and you know, in that, and we're getting them mixed up in the you know, transmissions are crossing.
And that we have, choice, and it's hard. We have to tweak, constantly tune, you know, it's like you're driving yeah. along and suddenly your radio gets really staticky and you have to like tune back in.
Exactly.
Or
exactly.
Your phone starts to fade out. So we're nearing the end of this wonderful conversation. So please tell us some more about the movie, the stage that you're at, the campaign that you're running, how people can participate, where they can see it, what the manifest vision is.
Absolutely. So the film is, we're pretty active on internet, you know, obviously Facebook, you can go to The Sync Movie. So the way that's spelled is TheSyncMovie. And so if you go on Twitter, Facebook, or YouTube, especially YouTube, we have a new extended teaser trailer, which I think really gives folks like a really nice idea of what sort of is in the film. The film is epic. I mean, it's really powerful. We're in the process of still cutting it down. We've been working on it for 4 years, and so it's just been this like really, I guess, it's become bigger than what we originally imagined, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, it sort of started out as a short film. And then when we realized we really had something, we had this incredible story. We had, when we went to the Synchronicity Symposium, we were able to, like, get the most profound information that I've Gary Bobroff, he talks about the rise of the divine feminine, which is a big part of the film. It's a lot of mm-hmm. a lot of the idea that women's voices are kind of coming through in this way, and it's more about like, you know, love and less about aggression, you know, and less about me against you. It's this idea that, you know, that suppression of the female voice that's been happening for thousands of years is potentially coming back if we just sort of open ourselves up to that. And I think through the film, you're getting a lot of different layers. You're getting the idea that synchronicity is connecting us, you know, and then you're getting the idea that there's a community of people that are also into synchronicity. So if you go to the Facebook, literally we get people every day telling us some sort of synchronicity story, or like, I keep seeing these numbers, what does it mean? And so it's cool because you're really interacting with other people that are seeing these things, if this is part of what's happening to you. And I think there's a lot of people that have been seeing these things for a while, and maybe they're sort of already open to it. But there's still additional information that you can receive from this film, if that sort of is old news for you as well. But the YouTube, I think, has a lot of great videos. We also have a web series called Sync Stories, and they're just one-off little stories, you know, good ways to sort of like show how synchronicity might have inspired you, or mm-hmm. how a metaphysical or supernatural experience, you know, shifted your awareness to this larger reality. And so we have a lot of that on YouTube, and then we're really active on Twitter. Our Indiegogo is now, we're about 40% funded, and we have 7 days left. So we're looking to get pre-sale orders of the film so that we can, you know, we can finish it. And ultimately, we really would like to put it out on a specific day on our own, you know, just right. us putting it out there, independent, you know, and then of course distribution. So the Spanish language version is we've already have translators and things like this. So we're looking for people to really contribute in any way they can. You know, we have some really cool perks. One of the perks is a
we have about 30 seconds. So
okay. We have a deluxe conscious music package is one of the perks. And so that's like 100 minutes of conscious music that's featured in the film. The film has beautiful art and music in it. So just go to Indiegogo.com, search for Time is Art, and support the film.
We have been talking with Katie Walker about this amazing film, Transforming Your Own Life Through Synchronicity and Being Aware of Who We Are and How We Are on the Planet. Katie, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
This was wonderful.
An amazing conversation.
It's been great. Thank you.